All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, February 9th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a chilly 18 degrees with snow fog and a coming storm here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Wednesday? That was the last live show. We titled the show Pooping Gold Nuggets, if you remember that one. DARPA, biohacking, gene WMDs, echo, EMF, and AI. And we looked at a bunch of different things, this new bacteria that they've discovered that they can feed it toxic metals and it'll poop out little gold nuggets. That's the polluter's dream, of course. We looked at DARPA and some of the things that they are working on in regards to protecting you from some sort of genetic WMD, some sort of mad bioscience gone mad, accidentally or on purpose. They want to be able to take a look at your epigenome to tell whether or not you've been exposed to any type of thing you're not supposed to, such as a bioterror agent or some sort of chemical weapon or some sort of pathogen. Well, I ran across another story today that caught my attention as well. I saw that DARPA just had their budget passed in front of Congress, and they got a nice big boost in funding. So that means this mad science is not going to end. But there is a brand new, as of February 28th, 2018, that's what it says, but that must be the Proposer's Day. It is called Friend or Foe Proposer's Day. DARPA's Biological Technology Office, and this is out of DARPA.mil, is hosting a Proposer's Day meeting to provide information to potential applicants on the structure and the objectives of the new Friend or Foe program. Friend or Foe aims to rapidly characterize the phenotype of unfamiliar bacteria to distinguish harmless organisms from potential pathogens. And remember, there's this drumbeat beating that we have this horrible flu epidemic that could turn into a pandemic that is spreading all over the globe. We also saw recently, I think this might have been yesterday, February 8th, out of South Korea, where they are holding the current 2018 Olympics, they have had a very public outbreak of the dreaded norovirus, and at least 128 people are sick, and another 1,200 people have been quarantined and are being tested for the virus. So let's normalize all this now, because there's going to be illness in our future as DARPA is working on some sort of new universal flu vaccine, and we've read about that a few times before. We're going to talk about that again. Additional details are available at the go.usa.gov website, and full details of the Friend or Foe program we made available in a forthcoming broad agency announcement posted to the Federal Business Opportunities website, and I think that's fbo.gov. DARPA hosts the Proposer's Day, blah, 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 and the general public can put in a proposal. Usually it's like high-tech companies or universities to help them come up with a solution to what ails them. Well, now here we go. Headline news. Physician, we need a universal flu vaccine and no more excuses. My late father, and that would be the author of the story, Henry I. Miller, could recall as a child the horrendous flu pandemic from 100 years ago, from 1918 to 1919. I think they're looking at the clock going, huh, it's about time again. Horse-drawn wagons piled with corpses rolled through the streets of Philadelphia, just like in the Monty Python Black Plague, bring out your dead, collecting people who had died. The death toll that winter was 15,556, and in total, more than half a million Americans died worldwide. The pandemic was the worst in history, claiming between 50 and 100 million lives. And I thought at one point we saw that Bill Gates came out and was warning about a pandemic that could take at least 30 million or more. We haven't seen numbers approaching those in a century. But seasonal outbreaks of flu sicken and kill many thousands of Americans, even in a good flu season. And this one happens to be a bad one. So according to the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more affectionately known as the CDC, each year since 2010, the flu has caused between 9.2 and 35.6 million illnesses, between 140,000 and 710,000 hospitalizations, look at the justification coming, and between 12,000 and 56,000 deaths in the United States. This flu season, which is still inflicting misery and debility on much of the country, is ominous. Statistics are likely to be on the high end of those ranges. Hospital emergency rooms and isolation wards are filling up with flu sufferers from around the nation. And remember, you can spread the flu just by breathing. And deaths are running ahead of recent years, except for Hawaii, of course. And the entire United States is experiencing, quote unquote, widespread flu activity. Moreover, pharmacies have reported shortages of the most common oral anti-flu medication, and that would be Tamiflu, and also of the intravenous solutions needed to keep hospitalized patients hydrated. Well, something that I found works very well for the flu is elderberry syrup. Look into it. It kills all different kinds of viruses. And we tried it in this household a couple years back, and it was quite miraculous. So check that out. They sell that in all the drugstores. Called Simbuco. Vaccination, of course, is the key to prevention. And I'm seeing all kinds of public service announcements about that. Go get your flu shot. Even if it is only 25% effective, it is the most effective way to protect you against the flu. According to estimates from the CDC, in six flu seasons starting in 2005-2006, flu vaccination against a variety of strains prevented almost 14 million cases. And that might seem impressive, but our current vaccines often are barely adequate. Too many vaccinated people still get the flu, and when it comes to research funding, our public health agencies seem little exercised about it. But because flu viruses mutate frequently, well, that's where the shape-shifting universal vaccine is going to come in. Vaccines are reformulated early in the year as a mixture of virus strains predicted to prevail during the next fall and winter. And depending on how good your selections are, during a given flu season, the effectiveness can vary widely. Since 2004-05 seasons, vaccine effectiveness has varied from 10% to 60%. I thought actually one of them was 0%. There was no protection whatsoever a few years ago. This year, the vaccine is a poor match, which means only 30% effective, in part because most illnesses are caused by a virulent strain called H3N2, against which the flu vaccine isn't very effective. One of the reasons for flu vaccine's relative ineffectiveness, of course, is that we make it in chicken eggs, and that takes a really long time, so we got to do some sort of mad science, mumbo jumbo, to get these producing like crazy. And we've talked about that before. DARPA had the Blue Angel program that started, I think, back in the mid-2000s. Where they were utilizing tobacco plants soaked in some sort of substance that forced them to uptake some sort of recombatant proteins that then allowed the tobacco plant to produce antibodies against the flu. And they were very successful. I don't remember the number. I don't have that story up in front of me, but I'll put it in the notes. They produced tens of thousands of vaccines in a very short period of time. Regulators should encourage manufacturers to stop using chicken eggs and instead prepare vaccines in cultured cells. And that would be cells that have been removed from animals and grown under controlled conditions. And I know I read about that as well. They were using mouse ovary cells to do that. And this method would produce vaccines with greater fidelity to target flu strains. And many U.S. licensed vaccines are already produced in this way, such as for rotavirus, polio, smallpox, hepatitis, rubella, and chickenpox, plus at least two flu vaccines. We need to research more adjuvants, chemicals mixed with the viral antigens to further boost our immune response, and of course, genetic modification of humans. But most of all, we need to accelerate research on the holy grail of flu prevention, and that would be a universal flu vaccine that would target a part or parts of the flu virus that remain unchanged among many different strains, even during the virus's rapid mutations. Universal vaccine has a potential to provide us with long-term protection from all strains of the flu. And I mean, that would work if they really were looking at that common thread that allows a virus to live, and then knocking that out by some sort of modification. So, all right, let's move beyond this story, because I came across another one, and this was out of the Times Picayune, which I'm not really sure what state that is. I don't know. It looks like some local Times publication. Google is now backing the development of, yes, a universal flu vaccine. Oh, this is out of New Orleans. NOLA.com. Google's venture arm is backing a private British company which is currently developing a vaccine that has the potential to fight all types of flu. The company has raised £27 million from investors, including GV, which is the venture capital arm of Google, according to Reuters. Vaxitech, which is a company founded by scientists at where? Oh, Oxford University. Uh-oh, that's where the Oxitech mosquitoes came from. Said that the funding would put its vaccine through a two-year clinical trial that involves over 2,000 patients. Their new vaccine works by using proteins at the core of the flu virus, which remains stable. So there you go. The vaccine also stimulates T cells, which that's some of that DARPA technology that they were working on, rather than antibodies. And currently, flu vaccines have to be changed every year. And the current predominant strain, that H3N2, has been the most severe since 2009 swine flu epidemic, ding, with 53 pediatric deaths reported so far this season. And the current vaccine available is the least effective against the H3N2 strain. However, the CDC reported that its effectiveness against two other strains are now appearing. H1N1 and influenza B appears to be higher. The Vaxitech's flu vaccine is successful in clinical trials. It could be ready to launch in 2023 or 2025 at the latest. Well, thank goodness that Google is working on a universal flu vaccine, because I came across a story yesterday that really made me raise an eyebrow. And I guess if I think long and hard about this, maybe I can see that this is something that could have been going on that they didn't notice until just now. But hey, story out of Newsweek. And this was from February 7th, 2018. They are announcing that more than 800 million viruses fall from the skies every single day in a square meter. So 800 million viruses, every square meter of land is dropping out of the sky. All right, Newsweek.com. The sky is absolutely riddled with viruses swept up from surfaces of the planet. And for the very first time, researchers have measured the number of viruses swarming around in our atmosphere and how many are falling back down to Earth. The team found billions of viruses traveling through the sky, which they believe could be the spread of remarkably similar viruses across wildly different areas of the globe. Probing the atmosphere from sites high in the Sierra Nevada mountains in southern Spain, the team discovered enormous numbers of viruses being swept up above 9,000 feet. Now, you know, I'm not a virologist by any means, but one of the things I do know is that viruses, as well as some bacteria, need favorable conditions to remain alive. They need some sort of host. Most of them, they need it to be kind of warm. And I don't think at 9,000 feet, it's very warm up there. But one other thing that I'm going to propose here is that if we have all these lethal viruses floating around everywhere, and they're in the upper atmosphere where they're exposed to more ultraviolet and solar radiation, didn't we already find in research that they discovered that when they sent MRSA up to the space station, that it made it more virulent? And now they had SpaceX, Elon Musk's one of the last shipments up to the International Space Station included MRSA for them to do research so they could get a leg up on antibiotic-resistant pathogens. Well, I think maybe we should worry about the 800 million viruses falling from the sky that they just mysteriously found. Every day, more than 800 million viruses are deposited per square meter above the planetary boundary layer, says University of British Columbia virologist Curtis Suttle, who is a senior author of the research published in the International Society for Microbial Ecology Journal. The planetary boundary layer, which sits in the lowest part of the troposphere, responds to conditions at the Earth's surface. And for the very first time, the scientists measured a number of viruses under the troposphere, which lies above the planet's weather system, but below the stratosphere. Viruses travel upwards on the back of sea spray and soil dust, and they can soar thousands of miles through the upper troposphere before settling back down on Earth. Now, of course, that does make some sense, but on the other hand, how come we've never had weather alerts about the jet stream that was carrying Ebola because it was blowing the winds from Africa? I mean, this is the very first time out of my lifetime that I've ever even heard something like this proposed. So I'm raising an eyebrow to this one a little bit, just as they're pounding the drums about how we need a universal prophylactic flu vaccine. We need to genetically modify ourselves and get our epigenome sequence to make sure that we have not been exposed to something that was considered a threat biologically, accidentally, or on purpose. The results shed light on the way these viruses spread across the planet, and Suttle explains, quote, roughly 20 years ago, we began finding genetically similar viruses occurring in very different environments around the globe. And it's quite conceivable to have a virus swept up into the atmosphere on one continent and deposited on another. Well, I don't know, if I were aware Florida is, and I would get hurricanes that tend to spin up off of the coast of Africa, I'd be a little worried about that one. The team found far fewer bacteria above the planetary boundary layer, with only tens of millions deposited per square meter. And the team thinks that this is because viruses have a lot more atmospheric sticking power than bacteria, where bacteria is carried away by rain. Bacteria and viruses are typically deposited back to Earth via rain events and Saharan dust intrusions. However, the rain was less efficient removing viruses from the atmosphere. And this might all sound terrifying because it's supposed to. Be afraid, be very afraid. Mutant viruses are raining from the sky. But the authors actually believe that such a microbe transportation mechanism can help ecosystems thrive. Rather than being a negative consequence, the deposition provides a seed bank that should allow ecosystems to rapidly adapt to environmental changes. Many of the viruses falling to Earth are likely not to be active. The deposition rates of viruses are huge, but we still need to determine what type of viruses and their viability to infect their hosts, which, you know, that was one of my first questions. More pertinent concern is the increasing load of particles into the atmosphere itself, viruses or not. This activity is usually associated with respiratory problems, and climate change, of course, will continue to drive this microbe transportation. Climatic change increases soil erosion and hurricane dynamics, and soil erosion, mostly in arid and semi-arid regions, is increasing the exports of dust to the atmosphere and the microorganisms associated with that dust. Hurricanes, so like I said, if you're in Florida, I'd be worried, also introduce big numbers of marine or microorganisms into the troposphere as well. And we're going to cover one more story. So that one was out of Newsweek. This one came out of Discover Magazine, and this is actually yesterday, and the title made me kind of chuckle. It was titled, Cloudy with a Chance of Viruses. That was cute. I, and that would be the author Bill Andrews, like a lot of other people on the internet, love rain, and what can be nicer than a cool, refreshing burst of liquid precipitation, a sound that is so soothing that people actually pay to hear it during dry spells. It's good for dirty walkways, good for plants, good for skydiving viruses, but what? Yes, as it turns out, but remember, we just found out that rain did not pull viruses out of the atmosphere that well. Yes, as it turns out, that the rains are particularly rife with falling viruses, or maybe not. A new study out this week in the International Society for Microbial Ecology Journal is a census of the viral invaders falling upon us at all times, and it is not pretty. While Carl Sagan apparently never said his famous catchphrase of billions upon billions, but I don't know about that one either, because I've actually heard him say that in video clips, the scientists behind the study did. And specifically, the downward flux of viruses ranged, and then they give a whole bunch of crazy numbers with exponents per day, meaning that you'll see greater than 7 billion of them per square meter a day in some areas. And they apparently hitch a ride from tiny bits of dirt and from seafoam swept into the wind. And then weather patterns allow them to float around in the atmosphere eventually before coming back down. Scientists already know that bacteria can travel this way, but we did not know about viruses. But the new research showed that viruses are logging all the air miles as they are 9 to 461 times more numerous. Rain and dust storms are good ways to bring both types of organisms back down to Earth, though viruses were less affected by the rain than the bacteria. Getting a read on the number of viruses falling from the sky answers a decade-old question among virologists. Apparently, they've been spotting viruses with remarkable genetic makeup similarities in different environments all over the world. So now we know how they're raining down from the sky. And perhaps it is just as simple as a virus getting swept up in the atmosphere on one continent and then drifting down in another, along with the billions of its closest friends. These new findings don't really change anything other than our understanding of things. Still, I at least never look at a rainstorm, dust storm, or clear blue sky the same way again. So guys, I really think, again, I know I've said this quite a number of times, but you start seeing the drums beating, this normalization, this be afraid, be very afraid, comply. We already have quarantines going on at the Olympics because look at all the security personnel have gotten sick, and now we've had to bring in soldiers for security. So I don't know about that one. So, all right. So here's another one. Remember I told you before, anytime you see, oh, never before seen, very first time ever observed, it's usually a good time to start paying attention. Attention. Well, this one's out of the New York Times, February 5th, 2018, titled, "This Mutant Crayfish Clones Itself and It Is Taking Over Europe." What mutant crayfish cloning itself? So wait, check this one out, because this sounds like it might have gotten out of a mad science laboratory hidden in somebody's dark basement. Frank Lyko, a biologist at the German Cancer Research Center, studies the 6-inch-long marbled crayfish. Finding specimens is easy, he says. Dr. Lyko can buy crayfish at a pet store in Germany, or he can head with colleagues to a nearby lake. He waits until dark and he switches on his headlamps and then wanders into the shallow water. The marbled crayfish will emerge from hiding and begin swarming around your ankles. He says it's extremely impressive. Three of us once caught 150 animals in an hour just with our hands. And over the past 5 years, Dr. Lyko and his colleagues have sequenced the genomes of the marbled crayfish. And in a study published on Monday, and that was just this week, the researchers demonstrate that the marbled crayfish, while common, is one of the most remarkable species known to science. Now, here's the kicker sentence. Before about 25 years ago, this species simply did not exist. Ding, 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 ding. A single drastic mutation in a single crayfish. This is like that fruit bat tree that they discovered in Africa that created the Ebola outbreak, produced the marble crayfish in an instant. It just came out of nowhere, and this mutation made it possible for the creature to clone itself, and now it has spread across much of Europe and has gained a toehold on other continents. In Madagascar, for example, word arrived in about 2007. It now numbers in the millions, and it threatens the native crayfish. We may never have caught the genome of the species so soon after it became a species, says Jen Falks, a biologist at the University of Texas at the Rio Grande Valley, who was not involved in the new study. The marbled crayfish became popular among German aquarium hobbyists in the late 1990s, and the earliest report of a creature comes from a hobbyist who told Dr. Lyko he bought what he described to him as a quote-unquote Texas crayfish in 1995. Yeah, that special wink Texas crayfish. The hobbyist, who Dr. Lyko declined to identify, was struck by the large size of the crayfish and its enormous batches of eggs. A single marbled crayfish can produce hundreds of eggs at one time. Soon, this hobbyist was giving away crayfish to his friends, and not long afterward, so-called marmal crabs, and that's what they call these, were showing up in pet stores in Germany and beyond. As marmal crabs became more popular, owners grew increasingly puzzled. The crayfish seemed to be laying eggs without mating, and the progeny were all female, and each one grew up ready to reproduce. In 2003, scientists confirmed that the marbled crayfish was indeed making clones of itself, and they sequenced small bits of DNA from the animals, which bore a striking similarity to a group of crayfish species called the Procambrias, native to North America and Central America. 10 years later, Dr. Lyko and his colleagues set out to determine the entire genome of the marbled crayfish. By then, it was no longer just an aquarium oddity. For nearly two decades, marbled crayfishes have been multiplying like tribbles. Remember Trouble with Tribbles? And the legendary Star Trek episode. And people would start out with a single animal, and a year later they would have a couple hundred. And many owners apparently drove to nearby lakes and dumped their marmal crabs. And it turns out that the marbled crayfish did not need to be pampered to thrive. Marmal crabs establish a growing population in the wild and sometimes walking hundreds of yards to reach new lakes and streams. Feral populations turning up in the Czech Republic, Hungary, Croatia, and Ukraine in Europe, and later in Japan and Madagascar. Now, Czech Republic, Hungary, Croatia, and Ukraine, isn't that where we read about some of those secret biotechnology labs that are being funded by our military? Working on insects and... Actually, these crabby things are a little bit near insects. They do have exoskeletons and things, so I thought it was kind of interesting. Sequencing the genome of this animal was not easy. No one had sequenced a genome of a crayfish yet that we know of. And in fact, no one had ever sequenced any close relative of a crayfish either. So now we have a good reason to do it. Dr. Lyko and his colleagues struggled for years to piece together fragments of DNA into a single map of its genome. And once they succeeded, they sequenced the genomes of 15 other species, including the marbled crayfish living in German lakes and those belonging to other species. The rich genetic detail gave scientists a much clearer look at the freakish origins of the marbled crayfish. And it apparently evolved from a species known as the slough crayfish, which is the Procambrius phallix, which lives only in the tributaries of the Satilla River in Florida and in Georgia. Scientists concluded that the species got its start when two slough crayfishes mated, and one of them had a mutation in its sex cell. Whether it be an egg or a sperm, the scientists can't tell. And normal sex cells contain a single copy of each chromosome, but the mutant crayfish sex cell has two. So somehow the two sex cells fused and produced a female crayfish embryo with three copies of each chromosome instead of just two. And somehow, too, these new crayfish did not suffer any deformities. Yeah, how interesting is that? As a result of all that extra DNA. It grew and it thrived, and instead of reproducing sexually, the first marbled crayfish was able to introduce her own eggs to start dividing into embryos. The offspring, which happened to be all females, inherited identical copies of all three sets of chromosomes, and they were clones. Now, I gotta tell you, when I just start thinking about some of the things that we've been going through over the years, you know, we have all of this, our planet is overpopulated stuff going on, and it's all leading to climate change, and oh my God, we have to stop reproducing. Well, you know what, if we just flipped a few switches, whoop, 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 put it in the water, or whatever, and all of a sudden now we start reproducing. Though I guess without males, we would get rid of the aggression quotient. I don't know, guys. This just seemed very bizarre to me that they have found a species that did not occur anywhere before 25 years ago. And now this thing is being born and reproducing all over the planet. Sounds like it got out of a laboratory. You know, I don't know. Call me silly. So, all right, where do we go from here? Well, let's continue on looking at DNA. So there's a story that came out February 5th, 2018. So this was last week or Monday. I don't know. I lose track of my days. I think it might have been Monday. Yes, it was Monday. Titled, How DNA Could Store All of the World's Data in a Semi-Tractor Trailer. Maybe even a self-driving semi-tractor trailer. Scientists see capricious in a stable medium is a potential answer to mountains of information that they have been collecting, that they will be collecting with the Internet of Things that they will need to sift through. Last October, Deep Purple's Smoke on the Water and Miles Davis's Tutu made history again, and not for musical contributions this time, but for scientific. Researchers from the University of Washington, as well as Microsoft and a company called Twist Bioscience, successfully stored these two recordings onto a DNA sequence that could be decoded and played back without any loss of quality. It was the latest sign that storing data on DNA could become a serious prospect. And scientists have long seen DNA as a potential storage medium because it can store large amounts of data in a very small space and that is stable over thousands of years. And if they encase them in glass, it could be millions. In 2012, scientists at Harvard, and that would include Georgie Porgy Church, stored the text of a book on DNA. And in early 2017, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, which is the government branch dedicated to national security research, announced plans to fund further research into DNA storage. If successful, this could be the answer to problems of archiving the increasing amounts of information the world is creating. And data storage is a much bigger problem than many people appreciate. Most digital archives, from music to research, are currently saved on magnetic tape. And we're going to have a problem with that in the future. Like a cassette tape, only much bigger and much more high-tech, magnetic tape is the cheapest way to store data. But with increasing content exponentially, however, tapes are going to fill up hundreds and hundreds of warehouses. And that tape does not store forever. You have to rewrite it, and the information will disappear after 10 years. Give it a little bit of magnetic stimulation, boop, and it's all gone. DNA, however, is very good for storing and copying information, as our own bodies can prove. Whether you are a virus, a cucumber, an elephant, or whatever, a computer scientist, Jan-Vec Ehrlich at Columbia University, says you store the most important information of your life in your DNA. The genetic molecule is extremely small, so encoding DNA in it would solve the real estate problem. We need about 10 tons of DNA to store all the world's data, and that is something that you could fit into a semi-tractor trailer. DNA also has longevity. DNA has been around for about 3.5 billion years, and it is not going to be obsolete even in the next 10,000. Emily Lipros, chief executive at Twist Bioscience, says that DNA is cheap. And yeah, we can print it too. And it is quick to copy. It takes $1 and 1 hour to copy a tube of DNA, says Ms. Leprost. And it may sound high, but if you have a tube, the equivalent of a data center, and you can copy the entire data center for $1 and 1 hour, that is absolutely unheard of. So guys, that's what we're going to be used for. Once the robots take all the jobs, you can sell yourself to the blockchain as a data storage vessel. That is my prediction. Translating the binary code, which makes up digital data, into chemical rungs that form DNA spirals is less complex than might be expected, according to Siromi Crisoe, assistant professor of chemistry and biochemistry at the University of California, Los Angeles. Professor Crisoe co-authored a 2012 paper in which he says, quote, probably one of the simplest science papers ever published in some ways, showed that the zeros and ones of binary code can be translated into pairings of DNA bases, and that would be your A, T, C, and G. So A could represent a 0, 0, T could represent a 0, 1, and so on. And DNA strands can then be built matching sequences of digital code to read the DNA. The DNA is run through a sequencer and then decoded. Synthesizing DNA, however, can be messy, and not all the molecules make it, and sometimes bits repeat. But to reduce the errors when reading back, Mr. Enrich and his team came up with an algorithmic solution akin to a Sudoku math puzzle. In Sudoku, even if you lose some of the hints, you can still solve the puzzle. So using the Sudoku technique, Mr. Ehrlich and his team were able to store the information at a density of 215 petabytes in one single gram of DNA and then read it back accurately. One petabyte is equivalent to 900 billion pages of texts, and DARPA has funded Mr. Elric to develop his system further. Of course they have. Computing architects and synthetic biologists are now getting together and designing systems to automate the DNA storage process and let you search the DNA for specific files. You know, they could capture you or inject you with some secret files. You could be walking around as an unknowing container to some sort of information. This is horrifying. Luis says, a computer science professor at the University of Washington, explains that the process involves wet parts, and that would be the suspended DNA and electronics. All of the liquid fluidics part has to be automated, he said. You're not going to employ 100 million people in data centers to move DNA around. The cost remains an obstacle, and while reading DNA sequences is now relatively cheap and easy, writing DNA can be prohibitively expensive, but not for too much longer. Twist Bioscience charges between 7 and 9 cents per DNA base. Storing 12 meg of data on a DNA costs around $100,000 right now. But I think DARPA was funding some sort of DNA assembly line at one point at Weiss Institute with MIT and Harvard involved as well. We read about that a long time ago. Robert Collison, a consultant at the biological engineering company called Biodesidic, says that for DNA drives to compete with a single tape drive, it would need to read and write the equivalent of around 10,000 human genomes a day. At present, he estimates that the global DNA synthesis industry writes just 3 human genomes worth of DNA per day. Ms. Leprost, whose company uses 3D printing techniques to write DNA, and we're going to get to some 3D printing stuff, is optimistic, however. We believe that we have a roadmap to be able to lower the cost of DNA synthesis by a millionfold, although she concedes that the time frame for achieving this goal is still unclear. So where do we go from here? Well, this one caught my attention out of Wired.com. January 24th, 2018, DARPA wants to build an image search engine out of DNA. So it's not just going to be Google's robot googly eyes, deep learning mechanisms, looking at cat videos. Google's going to be using DNA now to become an image recognizer. Most people use Google's search by image feature to either look for copyright infringements or for shopping. See some shoes you like on a frenemy's Instagram? Search will pull up all the matching images on the web, including that from sites that will sell you the same pair. In order to do that, Google's computer vision algorithms had to be trained to extract identifying features like colors, textures, shapes from vast catalogs of images. Louise says, the same one who was just in this last story we just read about, a computer scientist at the University of Washington wants to encode that very same process directly into DNA, making the molecules themselves carry out that computer vision work. And he wants to do it using your photos. Oh, great. On Wednesday, says his team at the University of Washington launched a social media campaign to collect 10,000 images from around the world and preserve their pixels as A, T, C's, and G's that make the building blocks of life. They've done this sort of thing before. In 2016, they encoded an entire OK Go music video, setting the record for the most amount of data stored in DNA. But this time, they decided to crowdsource the data, building a website where people can submit photos and encouraging people to share their images on social media with the hashtag #memoriesinDNA. DNA can last thousands of years, says. So this is essentially a time capsule. Yeah, that's what we heard about that gene coin, too. What do you want to preserve forever? The University of Washington's #memoriesinDNA campaign might be a bit of a gimmick, and there are plenty available high-quality image databases with which to train a molecular search engine. But the scientists behind this say it is a very real attempt to upend the last 6 decades of computing. DNA-based storage has so far been good for only that, encoding pixels and then locking them up in freeze-dried strands invisible to the human eye. So far, no one has figured out how to retrieve and process DNA-stored data, though I thought we just found out that they were doing that, but it was very slow, which is a necessary first step for creating any type of serious molecular computing platform. Who would want that exactly? Well, DARPA, for one. And in the last few months, the Defense Department's agency has tasked with funding scientists most far out hopes, and they've begun investing millions in discovering radical non-binary ways to work with the data. Molecules offer a very different approach to computing than zeros and ones in our existing digital systems, says Ann Fisher. We've heard about Ann Fisher before, program manager for DARPA's Molecular Informatics Program, which has so far awarded $15.3 million worth of projects to Harvard University, which is where Joju Porgy Church works, Brown University, the University of Illinois, and the University of Washington. The global community is creating data at a tremendous rate, and developing new approaches to access and process this information is critical to address the looming shortfalls in storage capacity and computational speed. The digital age began with a simple act of delegation, man outsourcing his memory to the machine, first in vacuum tubes, then with transistors, tape disks, and flash drives. And after more than 60 years, the essential logic-based architecture described by John von Neumann still undergirds modern computing infrastructures. And by any measure, it has served humanity well, or not. But its limits are becoming apparent as humans create ever more complex data, and they want to be able to get every drop that is produced down to a biological level by every human being on the planet, and then collate, bag, tag, and draw insights from that data. And so, of course, we got to be able to find a way to store it all that will last for thousands of years. Moore's Law has been all about miniaturization of devices. And electronics are great and will continue to exist, of course, but molecules are the final frontier when it comes to miniaturization. And that is Eric Drexler with his molecular factories and nanotechnology and being able to make living computers. We're going to get on that one of these days. We looked a lot at that programmable and active matter in the show that I ran yesterday, which was a repeat. Sorry about that. But I thought it was quite important. We're going to get back there as well. Chemistry offers an untapped palette of molecular diversity, properties such as structure, size, charge, and polarity that could be harnessed for information processing. Remember, all of life is going to be enslaved. In this case of DNA, its structure that does the heavy lifting. And Strauss will be working with Cez to first extract all of the visual features from crowdsourcing images and then map them into strings of A, T, C's, and G's. And each photo might then get tens of thousands of unique DNA segments, each one encoded for a curve or a vertical line or a patch of blue. Then they can introduce a coded query just the way they would type in a few keywords in a Google search, except this query would be a string of DNA that corresponds to some of those visual features. And each query sequence would then get a special coating of magnetic nanoparticles, ding, ding, and drop a few of these into a micro test tube of DNA where 10,000 images are stored in a few millimeters, and they will grab the sequences that are a match. Then you just need a magnet to haul them out and a sequencer and some sort of algorithm to turn them back into visual images. That's how they hope it'll work anyway, and the core of the DARPA project is figuring out which mechanisms are best equipped to do molecular processing. We are focusing on visual data because it is by far the largest type of data in the world, and we think DNA's specific binding properties make it well suited for that, but I guess we'll see. No pun intended. So other researchers are leveraging different physical properties of DNA to encode information. Oligika Malkovich's group at the University of Illinois isn't manufacturing huge amounts of synthetic DNA, but rather making small cuts in naturally occurring bacterial DNA. These changes can be counted, which makes them essentially addition and subtraction operators, one of the building blocks for programming languages like Java. And DNA isn't the only molecule that DARPA is interested in. Brenda Rubenstein is a theoretical chemist at Brown, where she is working on quantum computing, encoding bits of information as either atoms, ions, photons, or electrons. But now she is extending that idea into organic compounds, specifically ones that have multiple places to attach R groups, which would be the variable parts of the molecules that lend them different physical and chemical properties. Running different reactions modifies those R groups in predictable ways, which makes them good for computing basic linear algebra equations. And they have so many properties. There is an incredible capacity for storing and processing information that I think small molecules are an obvious choice for broadening the scope of computing. Guys, they literally are turning biological and mimicked biological with synthetic material into computing devices. That is not good for our future, especially as we find our value as humans, as the robots come to take all the jobs and we can just sit around and eat grapes. Remember I told you there is no free lunch? Well, this is going to be the next thing that you'll be able to monetize to make money, is to start selling yourself to the machine. Molecules like DNA might prove to have some serious advantages over the in silico state of the art. They've got a way denser storage potential, they last way longer, and they may be even to process data way more in parallel, but they are not a silver bullet. DNA, like computer code, can still be hacked. Remember that one. And it's hard to see how you will get a soup of small molecule reactions crammed under the hood of your smartphone. But it's fun to at least imagine, yes, or have nightmares about, that years from the future, now that the Department of Defense might be building underground bunkers, not for server farms, but for, like I said, always underground down long, dark hallways. Not for server farms, but for trays of microscopic glass beads, a nation's secret held in freeze-dried DNA. It's got to be a little scary. I don't know, guys. When I read about this stuff, I start to get all kinds of horrifying images in my head. So, all right, this came up in a story a couple stories ago, but I pulled the story up because I remembered we covered this back in 2012. Researchers at Harvard University with good old Georgie Porgy Church encoded an entire book into DNA, and they are now messing around with it as a storage medium. August 16th, 2012. This has been going on for a while, but the reason why I wanted to bring this up, because there was a news story, and we can thank Camille for this one, that came out yesterday, 20 hours ago. Human sequencing pioneer, this is one of the guys who discovered CRISPR-Cas9, Georgie Porgy Church, wants to give you the power to sell your DNA on the blockchain. Now, we had already read about that gene coin where you could get your DNA sequenced and then encode it into the coin, and it'll go out and send it to all the different branches of different types of cryptocurrencies to essentially be out there forever. Well, this is a new one. The blockchain is the buzziest thing on the internet these days, and now MIT professor and godfather of the Human Genome Project, George Church, so he's at MIT now as well. I knew he was working between Harvard and MIT as part of the Broad Institute. Georgie Porgy Church wants to put your genes on it. And we had kind of contemplated this before, but I guess it's true. His new startup called Nebula Genomics plans to sequence your genome for less than $1,000, which is the current going rate for a whole genome sequencing, and then add your data to the blockchain, which might even be stored in DNA, who knows, through the purchase of what they are calling a Nebula token. The idea sounds outlandish, but not as outlandish as uploading your mind files to the blockchain, which we read about before. But Church and his colleagues laid out in a recently released white paper that this will put the power of genomics into the hands of the consumer. Of course, it's good for you, as opposed to companies like 23andMe and Ancestry DNA, which in that fine print, and we covered that a while back, you actually give them unlimited rights to do whatever they want with your DNA. So don't do it. I'm telling you, don't do it. Which holds your genomic data after you take the spit tube test. These companies then sell that data in large swaths to pharmaceutical and research companies, and one of which, 23andMe, has spun off as one of their subsidiaries to make drugs for free on your DNA that you paid them to sequence. However, using the blockchain, consumers can then choose to sell their own data directly to the pharmaceutical companies. And of course, when the humans don't have any more jobs, that'll be the only way that you'll be able to make a living. Many people have yet to sequence their data, mostly due to cost or privacy concerns, or you're smart like us. but with the option then to sell that data to drug companies, possibly to discover cures for rare diseases, and make a buck while doing it could sweeten the incentive to sequence. Those buying up tokens and sequencing their DNA through Nebula don't have to sell it for money, of course, and Nebula says that they can still discover insights about their own genetics through the company app without sharing it elsewhere if they desire. However, all bought and sold data will be recorded on the blockchain, which is immutable and live out there forever, which is a technology for allowing the recording of all transactions using a key code only known to the person who holds that information. And it will always be out there. That's the one thing. The blockchain will always be out there. That's the big sale about it. It is going to be something that will be out there forever and distributed across the interwebs. Will people go for this new proposal to buy a token, sequence their own data, and then sell it directly? Well, Nebula is too new to tell right now. It hasn't even announced when or if it'll hold a token sale. The tokens might also not accumulate in value like Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, as they are only redeemable for an individual's DNA data, which the company said it will do in partnership with Veritas Genetics, which is a company the church has also co-founded. Yeah. Oh, scratch your back, you scratch mine. Sequencing costs are likely to drop in the future, so a Nebula token could also drop in value as the price goes down. However, as Nebula co-founder Dennis Gershon told Stat News about the announcement, people will probably be directly and indirectly buying tokens from individuals to resell them to data buyers to try to make a profit. Co-founder Kamal Abdad also noted that as sequencing costs drop, they will attract more buyers. And further, he says the size of the study will grow, requiring more tokens for purchase, and these factors will help maintain a high demand for Nebula tokens. In another few startups like Encryptogen, LunaDNA, and Zennome have mentioned building platforms where individuals can sell their DNA data as well, though none of them offer whole genome sequencing, and folks would need to obtain their data from a third-party source first, like 23andMe. Those interested in buying tokens and selling their DNA through Nebula will have to wait a bit. The platform is not so open at the moment. However, the company says it should be ready in the next few months. So where does that take us? Well, talking about ways to make money once the robots take all the jobs, maybe you don't have to sell all your DNA, but here's a good one. This special suit, we might have covered this when it came out December 18, 2017. This special suit can convert your body heat into energy for mining cryptocurrency, and that would be for connecting to a blockchain and encrypting the next block. That's what they do. That's what mining is for. And this is a Dutch-based Institute of Human Obsolescence. And they've carried out work dedicated to maximizing human labor in the light of inevitable robot takeovers in the labor industry. So all you got to do is lay down and put the suit on, and you can create body heat. And I think it takes like 4,300 people to create enough body heat to mine a crypto coin. But whatever, you can still make money doing it. So a Dutch organization known as the Institute of Human Obsolescence has taken a proactive approach, which essentially involves mining human capital, much like Bitcoins, for use in the future. For the past 2 years, since 2015, so almost three, it has been involved with several research projects that are centered around the important links between human capital and biological labor and data production labor. Through their approach, both qualitative and quantitative, they have been able to carry out some unique projects, such as ones where they are able to mine cryptocurrency via a bodysuit that collects excess human body heat. And this suit stores the body heat thanks to a thermoelectric generator, and then afterward converts it into usable electricity that then can be used to mine cryptocurrency and get you a micropayment to your Bitcoin wallet or whatever. So here's another one. I thought this was kind of along these same lines. This is out of ubergizmo.com. Heat generated by Bitcoin mining used to grow food. Now, remember, they've been crying about all this energy that is wasted from all this cryptocurrency mining. That's why China just kind of shut down some of the mining farms, because their electricity was cheap. They're like, hey, it's being wasteful. And that's why a lot of your university students who have free electricity in their dorm rooms are doing it as well. They're building mining rigs and doing it for free on the university's dime. Well, this one heat generated by Bitcoin can be used to grow food. Of course, this is going to sell the green picture. The misconception that some people have about mining for cryptocurrency like Bitcoin is that all they need is a couple of PCs with some powerful hardware. They could sit back and let the money roll in. But we suppose that is not too far from the truth, although what many people are missing is how much it costs for electricity to run those rigs 24/7. On top of that, how will they cool it all down given the heat that's generated? Turn off your natural gas. And it seems that over in Canada, a certain Bruce Hardy might have the solution, which is to take the heat generated from the Bitcoin mining rigs and use it to help grow food. He is the president of the Minera Group, which is a business focused on developing, of course, here's that keyword, sustainable and intelligent food production systems. And he also mines for Bitcoin in his spare time. All right, guys, in the last couple minutes here, I didn't get to mention this on Wednesday, and I want to make sure I mention it today. We've published our third article this week. It went up on Monday on techspot.com. It is titled Blockchain Explained, and that is the underlying technology underneath cryptocurrencies that is going to be used as this quote-unquote immutable database of bagging, tagging, and tracking the Internet of Everything that is coming. How it works, who cares, and what its future may hold. Make sure you check that out. It was published February 5th, 2018. Author is listed as Jay Stanley, which is supposed to be me, and my anonymous co-author, who is a listener to the show. Thank you very much. I actually was pretty happy with the story, and if you don't typically understand what is going on with blockchain, I recommend you read it. It was a good read. All right, so where do we go from here? Let's do one more thing about blockchain. Startup, this is out of the Coin and Telegraph, which is a cryptocurrency publication. Startup wants to connect thousands, and I said thousands, of 3D printers in a blockchain-based network hub. It might have started as a simple printing small objects over the last couple of years, but 3D printing technology has now outgrown itself. It is now possible to 3D print tiny structures using living cells or print a whole house in 24 hours. So now they're joining forces over the blockchain, dubbed Network Robot Workforce. This network will be able to change the traditional industry norms on time to market and production cost, and their blockchain-based online platform will function as a facilitator between different innovative 3D manufacturing projects, and it could greatly reduce production costs. Well, here's one thing that I remembered while I was reading this. So let's put thousands of 3D printers on the blockchain. But there was also something we came across a while ago about advances in vaccines. 3D printed vaccinations will improve the administration of vaccines.